You're listening to Second Stories, created and produced by Second Story, with me, Abigail Brocker, as your host. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia, working to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. We help homeless youth and youth in crisis step away from their first story, one often marked by abuse, hardship, and crisis, and write their second story, full of hope and promise. We're starting off this new season with a special episode about COVID-19 and its impact on our work and the young people in our community. We begin with Judith, Second Story's CEO, to talk about how the pandemic has affected our work. As Second Story's primary decision maker and leader, Judith gives us a bird's eye view of how COVID-19 has both impacted Second Story overall and, more broadly, the youth who seek services like ours, both in our community and beyond. Judith, will you tell us a bit about yourself, your role at the organization, how long you've been here since we have not yet heard from you on the podcast?
Well, I've been with Second Story for 25 years, and I literally never thought that I would be at any one job for more than about three at the most, because I always like to have change and have growth and do new things. I never wanted to come to work and do the same thing every day. So it really surprised me staying at Second Story for as long as I have. But I think there are a number of reasons. I love kids, the situations that the young people that we're working with find themselves in just cry out for having someone who can help them. Mm-hmm. And I've never come to work and done the same thing every day. It's always something new and different. And we've been able to grow the organization quite a bit to be able to meet needs of people and, you know, as they evolve, as we find them. One thing's grown out of another. It hasn't been, let's go chase the dollars for this or let's go chase the dollars for that. It's just been seeing needs and challenges and trying to work for ways to address them. And so that's kind of at least my years at Second Story, how it's grown and evolved.
Yeah, which is more than half the time that the organization has existed, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
The majority of our growth in terms of the history I know of us has happened under your leadership.
There was growth and change before I joined. There's been, you know, a common thread of work with mental health issues and just with young people who are in unsafe situations and trying to provide that safety that they need. The vision of the organization has been pretty consistent over the years that we're looking to try to create a community where all young people have the support that they need from caring adults so that they can succeed as they move into adulthood. And hopefully that comes from a family, but when it doesn't, we've been trying for, 48 years to create an alternative so that those young people who may not have the support of a family network are able to succeed as well.
Right. So you touched on something a moment ago when you talked about 2008, I know people have been comparing COVID to 2008, and some people are like, no, you really can't draw that comparison. But I guess we'll see how they are similar and different in a few years. But when you first heard and understood the seriousness that COVID-19 was going to present in the U.S., what were you most nervous about in terms of the organization?
For me, I think one of the things in 2008, and once again here in 2020, one of the first concerns is I know that the demand for services is going to increase because, you know, as young people lose their jobs or become homeless at higher rates, as families become more stressed, young people need more help. And part of the reason why all of that stress and homelessness is increasing is because of lack of funding. And so how do we navigate if we lose funding, if we lose government support, or if the community is, you know, saying, hey, I can't afford to give to you because I have to, you know, make my mortgage payment. And so that's always a concern. It's like, how do we get sufficient funding to be able to meet the increased needs of young people in our community and keep them safe? And fortunately, in 2008, we were able to secure funding to start the Homeless Youth Initiative. We kept the support of our community, and we were able to do the work that needed to be done. So far in 2020, that has been the case as well. But this is the beginning. We don't know where coronavirus is going to go. You know, as we're talking right now, places have started opening up and cases are increasing.
Right.
And, you know, so, and I think the dual fears of if we lock everything down, we're destroying the economy, there won't be any money to meet the needs of people who need the help, versus the yes, but if we open up, we're going to be losing people and straining the capacity of our medical system. So it's a balancing act. I don't know where it's going to end. I don't know how long it's going to be. And so I'm thinking of this time not as a sprint, but as a marathon.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we've spoken about it in that way internally. And I agree. I've thought about it a lot in that way too, and about how this is going to be with us for a long time. As you think about the future and this marathon, what are things that you have been finding encouraging based on the past few months and keeping at the forefront of your mind going forward in the next, you know, year, or maybe more, as we continue to deal with this?
Well, the thing that has encouraged me is that we've had a tremendous amount of support from the community, both financial and with donations of masks and food and supplies. And you know, that's been an incredible help and support. Some of the government supplemental funding, the recognition that the young people in the community are being affected by this has also been a huge help. The things that concern me are that as we run a marathon, people will run out of steam, you know, basically that there will be a time when there isn't enough. And then what will we do? The other concern I have is we've been very fortunate to be able to keep all of our staff safe and to be able to keep the young people in our programs safe. In our community work, I know that our staff have been distributing food. They've been doing a tremendous amount with door drops of educational supplies for young people who aren't on the internet, of taking food to people when they know that the family is sick, that they have, in fact, contacted coronavirus. They're dropping food and supplies on these people's doorstep because there isn't any other way for them to get it. You know, using long tables to try to keep the 6 feet distance while they're distributing not just basic food supplies, but sanitary supplies and masks and information from the county that folks wouldn't necessarily have access to any other way. They're doing three-way calls with people to help them apply for unemployment because the language barrier is so intense that they are having difficulty in understanding what is being requested. It's very encouraging that so far no one's gotten sick, but I mean, we're washing hands, social distancing, wearing masks, doing all the right things, but I still sit there and you know, fingers crossed, it's like no one gets COVID because of the work that they're doing. And yeah, and just the, you know, the thought of the Second Story for Teens in Crisis is open. We're currently, instead of putting two young people in each bedroom, we're only doing one so that we can keep the distance. Everyone's wearing masks. We're separating people out while they're eating. You know, everything we can do to make sure everyone is safe. But what happens if inadvertently we have a young person who has coronavirus come into the shelter?
Right.
I'm just, fingers crossed, please let that not happen. So those are kind of the fears.
So you mentioned some of these things just now, but at a high level, will you go over how our programs have needed to change because of these kind of safety precautions to keep staff and youth safe, and what adaptations we've made to accommodate those changes.
Well, we're very fortunate that we've got the technology that we do. I mean, had this happened 20 years ago,
yeah,
we would be,
so
we would be like, I don't know what we would be doing.
Yeah.
But it would be a whole different ballgame. The fact that we can use Zoom and WhatsApp and Skype and FaceTime, whatever, to do case management, to do family counseling, check in is great, especially in our community-based programs.
Yeah.
They're working as long or longer hours than, you know, they did mm-hmm. prior to the pandemic starting. And that's a place where technology has really helped. We operate Fairfax County Family Resource Centers in Colmore and Springfield. They're both in communities that have a high percentage of recent immigrant families, largely Hispanic population, but not exclusively. And they're areas that are some of the most linguistically isolated in the county. And so when we had to close the doors on the resource centers because they weren't safe to keep open, even with people, you know, even limiting people, the number they could come in at any one time, mm-hmm. our staff put their cell phone numbers, their work cell phone numbers on the doors, and people have been calling them for assistance. And, yeah. and they've been getting it that way. And as I mentioned before, doing the food distribution, both out of the centers with it on an open air on the table, but also taking it to young people's houses. We're doing that in Annandale, where we have another program. We call it the Safe Youth Project for 4th, 5th, and 6th graders. And the staff are literally taking food and educational materials and messages from the schools and messages from the county and masks and dropping them on people's doorsteps. That's pretty low tech.
Yeah.
Those families also frequently don't have access to the internet. So, you know, they can't do the distance learning the same way that many others. I know the schools are working to try to get everybody connected and make sure everyone has the computer supplies that they need, the internet, the Chromebook. Right now, it's not there yet. And so we're the only connection those kids have to what's going on at school, you know, and so trying to keep them engaged, dropping off games that are both fun and educational, trying to organize through Zoom some little competition among the high schoolers who participate. And it's both, once again, it's both fun and educational, so that you know, we're not losing completely all of the school year.
We talk so much about why youth are so much more vulnerable right now. I think one of the things that we talk about a lot, and that I know I've heard stories about from programs and things, is just the opportunity gap. The fact that school is something that is such an important connection for youth in the teen centers and youth in Second Story for homeless youth. And we partner with the schools. You know, we rely on such a big network of community support ourselves too, from partner organizations. And not having that, it creates this big gap. And a huge part of our mission is creating opportunities for youth. Can you speak to that at all and how important it is for us to make sure that in this time, youth are not, you know, it's cliche, but falling through the cracks or falling into that opportunity gap?
Well, I think it's been a concern all along, because the young people that we work with are oftentimes already struggling in school. They're frequently English as a second language students, or they're students who have come from homes where they may not have the support of the parent or guardian to stay in school. Second Story for homeless youth, you know, those young people don't have the support of a parent or guardian. And so there's a gap already that the schools acknowledge and are trying to bring students up to speed, all kinds of opportunities within the educational system. But now that we're on lockdown and the schools are closed, those programs are not going. And for a young person who is from a middle or an upper class home where there's internet, there's Wi-Fi, there's a laptop, you know, they connect up and do their classes. My neighbors have 2 9-year-old twins, and she purchased a homeschooling package, and they've been doing classes, you know, for ever since school let out in, you know, back in March. They just finished up their classes, and now they're doing virtual summer camp with, you know, different activities every day. There's art day and there's yoga day. And, you know, so they're in a situation where they're still getting the education, still getting the mental stimulation, still getting the connections to other kids because there are other kids participating in these camps. And the young people that we're working with often in Colmore and Annandale and Springfield, the families don't have internet. And there isn't a laptop or multiple laptops. There may not even be anywhere quiet where you can go to do the classwork. So, you know, they're falling further behind. I've read variously that this outbreak is putting students back 7 months on their education, nine months on their education. And I'm worried that the young people that we're working with are going to fall even further behind than that. A lot of them move around a lot. And years ago, I remember going to testify to the Board of Supervisors, and I took a young woman with me. She talked about how she and her sister had been in Colmore and going to school, and they'd been a part of, or she had been a part of the Safe Youth Project. Her sister had been too young. And they left here, and they moved to North Carolina for a while. And, you know, parent found an employment opportunity there. And she said, and, you know, they didn't have anything like that in North Carolina.
Right.
And we didn't know, you know, we just kind of hung out and, you know, didn't do real well in school. And I didn't have the help in school that I had here. And she said, and then we came back and my sister is in the Safe Youth Project and I'm in going to the teen center, the Colmore Teen Center. And she said, and it makes such a difference. And she said, because in North Carolina, nobody was telling me that I could go to college.
Right.
That there was a reason that I should try to do well in school.
Right.
And so I didn't really understand that until I was here. And they said, you can do this. You can do this. What do you want to do? You can, you know, do well in school and you can do that. And it gave her a reason to do well in school. And she said, you don't have that everywhere.
Right.
And so that sort of motivation is one of the things that we try to give to all of the young people in our programs. The idea that what is it you want to do? Let us help you achieve it. Because if you work hard, you have a shot at it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I mentioned on this podcast before is we talk so much about the physical support, the immediate support. But so often when I talk to youth who've graduated from the programs, the things that stand out to them the most are the emotional and mental support. Someone telling them they could do it, the life skills support. And I think that's more important now than ever that we're providing that for youth. And it's something that we can do over the phone or over Zoom or something like that. And that's, I'm really thankful for that, that support doesn't have to pause.
Oh, I am too. And I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a young person who has had, you know, contact with school go away, contact with teachers go away.
Yeah.
They're worried that they won't have enough food. You know, apparently we've had kids standing in the food lines that we have to distribute food who are crying because they're worried that they won't get anything to eat. And, you know, that just breaks my heart.
Right.
But the idea that there are people who care enough that they're dropping food on your doorstep.
Yeah.
I hope that makes that young person and that family feel that they are valued.
For people who listen to something like this and they're like, you know what, I need to do more. I want to do more. I'm one of those people who's middle upper class and, you know, able to buy my kids' homeschool curriculum or whatever. What are some ways through Second Story that we're really finding support valuable right now?
Well, I know that you have a newsletter that goes out.
Yes.
And that would be the best place, that or the website, to check and see what is needed, because it changes, you know, very early on. We're dropping like 2 rolls of toilet paper at young people's houses. You know,
that was one of the things that I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this time living in the rationing of the toilet paper.
I know. And so trying to find a supply of toilet paper for, you know, 50 plus kids who didn't have the ability to stockpile it before all of this started was like, I've been informed that we're okay on toilet paper now. So
that's good to
hear. But who knows? You know, I mean, when this conversation airs, it might not be.
Right.
I have no way of knowing. So I would say probably the best way to check and see how to best help, what's most needed, is either on the website or follow the newsletter or Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes for this episode, the COVID-19 Task Force newsletter, which talks about immediate needs in kind and things that come up. And there are all different kinds of things in there. I mean, some of it is donating, you know, canned goods or fresh goods. Some of it is creative ways to fundraise. And some of it's things that I wouldn't have thought of at the beginning. Like, we're seeing that there are a lot more scams online in terms of looking for rooms to rent and stuff, because people are really preying on people who can't afford their living situation anymore. And, you know, the staff at Second Story for Homeless Youth is looking for reliable rooms so that they don't waste their time trying to figure out what's a scam and what's not. Thank you so much for going over this with us. It's been interesting to get a deeper dive into it in this day to day, but it's also interesting to just hear a higher level and how everything pieces together. And I know I speak for not just myself when I say that I'm thankful for your leadership in this and the ways that you've helped us adapt really quickly and still provide services to youth and working to keep staff safe. Thank you for that. And thanks for your time. And I'm hopeful and confident that when we are through this marathon, we will be better off.
I still hope, maybe I'm wrong and it will be a sprint.
I know, we can be optimistic about that, right?
Yeah, I'm
maybe
hoping it's
wishful
sprint,
thinking, but I'm trying
to prepare for it to be a marathon.
Yeah, I know, me too.
Yeah, and I also, you know, I appreciate the thank you for what I do, but I have to tell you, we have just an incredible staff at Second Story. They have gone so far above and beyond and helping the community and in helping young people that I am just in awe of everything that they have been doing. I know they're not technically first responders, but they sure are out there on the front lines.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm thankful for that too. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Second Stories. If you enjoyed this episode, we would be so thankful if you rated our podcast and left us a review. Be sure to also hit subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Second Stories is created and produced by Second Story with support from our technical director, Franklin Vaughn. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia that works to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. Learn more about what Second Story does and how you can support us at second-story.org. We hope you'll join us next time.